Welcome to Real Money with David Holland, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. David is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of financial experience. And because he actually provides advice to clients on a daily basis, our hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He also offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Holland Advisory Services and Holland Insurance Services are separate affiliated companies that share common ownership under Holland Financial. Commentary given during this radio program is usually pretty smart, but should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities should not be considered an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and financial planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual's situation, only if you hire David and his firm to help you, and only available where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here comes the unfiltered truth about money, investing, and retirement planning from a man who will give it to you straight. No bias and no spin. Here he is, David Holland.
Thank you, smoky voice announcer guy. All right. Let me get to some more questions. I love that you're emailing me questions, ladies and gentlemen. It's really a treat for me because it makes it a lot, I'll be honest with you, it makes it very interesting for me to do the show. Now my voice is scratchy because I made fun of the smoky voice guy. Hold on. Okay, there we go. All right. That's fate. What is that? Karma? Karma got me for being funny. Okay, so I love that you are writing me here. If you have a question, you want me to answer it on the radio or maybe in one of my financial columns, info@davidholland.com. All right, so Bill did that. Bill's in Volusia County, and Bill was actually following up on the column he read recently that I talked about estate and gift taxes, and he loved my explanation. Thank you very much for that, Bill. And his question was, and this is an excellent, excellent question, Bill. His question was, and it was in following up to, I talked about misunderstanding that people have about the $14,000 gift limit. And I basically explained in my column that it's not a real limit and it really doesn't have ramifications for you. If you give somebody $100,000, you exceed that $14,000 limit. You're not going to be taxed on that until you've used up all of your $5,250,000 lifetime gift and estate exemption amount. Okay. So Bill's question is, well, I get that. I understand that. However, the government can still legislate changes to that lifetime gift and estate limit. And he's absolutely correct. It's been in recent history, it's been as low as $600,000 or as high as it is to what it is at the taping time of this show, $5,250,000. It could certainly be more. It could certainly be less. In fact, there was a few moments in time where we were concerned that the legislators and powers to be, those guys with the white wigs up in Washington, were going to let the exemption fall all the way back down to a measly $1 million instead of over $5 million, which is where it is today. And I say that tongue in cheek, that $1 million is still a lot of money, but for people with estates that this would affect, that would not be anywhere near where it was. So Bill's question is this, and it's very valid. What if they change it? And let's say that you have a significant estate. And I know I'm talking to a narrow population, but this is interesting for everybody because it could affect everybody depending on what they do. So let's say you've made gifts and you've exceeded the $14,000 gift exemption. You give a home, which is another question I'm going to get to. Another listener had a question about gifting a home. But you give your home to somebody or you give them a lot of money and you exceed the $14,000. And it's, now, let's say it's below the $5 million. Let's just say it's an even $2 million. Okay, just a safe example. You give away $2 million to a person in 1 year. It's below the $5 million, there's no gift tax. No gift tax for you, no tax to them. Now, Bill's question is, what if later they drop the exemption back to a million, but you've given away $2 million when it was a $5,250,000 exemption? So you've given away more than the current law would allow you to give without taxes, but before it wouldn't have been. Here's the answer. The way the law has been written so far is that they can't come back and get you on that. In other words, if the exemption amount is $5,250,000 and you've got $6 million and you give $5 million of it to a friend, okay, or your child, and you're under the exemption amount, you file your 709, you do everything by the book, and then 5 years from now, they drop the exemption back down to a million. With the way the laws are written today and the way they have done this in Washington, they wouldn't come back and get you. Now, for those that are not very trusting of government, which I understand, Of course, they could still do something retroactively, but it's never happened. That would be unprecedented, and it would be extraordinary or extraordinary, depending on how you like to say that. So the short answer is, if you've already made the gifts, they can't come back and get you. They can't come back and get that. Excellent question, Bill. And I love that you were really reading into my column, because, and I actually helped a family not long ago address that very issue, because they were concerned about the fact that the exemption amount might be lower in the future. So let me kind of turn your question around and say, if you have considerable assets, now may be the time to make those inter vivos lifetime gifts, file the 709, especially if it is an appreciating asset. One of the reasons people give money sometimes to their children or grandchildren during their lifetime, instead of waiting until they die and leaving it with their estate, is they want to get the appreciation out of their estate. Well, what does that mean? Well, let's say you've got a stock that's worth $100 a share, a bunch of it. You go ahead and give it to your children or grandchildren. You take advantage of the exemption, and then that stock goes from $100 to $200 a share by the time you die. If you had held on to it, the $200 times however many shares you have would be part of your estate. You know, then you would, the gift and estate tax thing would be calculated. Estate taxes for your death. If you gave them the $100 stock during your lifetime, the $100 appreciation is in their estate. So it's a way of shifting appreciation if it's an appreciating asset. So these are all things to consider when doing the planning. So my point is that now is the time to think about some of these gifts when you have a high exemption. All right, so let me go to the second question that is somewhat related. I had mentioned it earlier about gifting a home. Another reader of my column had a question. Jim is also in Volusia, and Jim asked, he wrote in, he said, thank you very much for your article, your column that appeared recently. I'm especially interested in your reference to transfer of property, lifetime gift, inter vivos transfer. His question is about my comment about whether it be taxes being owed. And he said, look, I'm not sure. I've got a home that is $250,000 in value, and I'd like to give it to a good close friend. And his question is, if he does this, will he have to pay any gift taxes? And now I have to make a couple of assumptions, Jim. You have not used up your $5,250,000 gift exemption. And so you've got this home that's worth $250,000. You can give that to your friend. There will be no gift tax. You file your 709. You probably have to get an appraisal. Attach that to the 709. That's usually required when you are giving something that is subject to valuation. Now, if it's a stock, you know, you can use the value on a certain date, the date of the gift. But if you're talking about a home, then that, you know, you probably have to have an appraisal and things like that. But so you file your 709. That $250,000 obviously is well below the $5,250,000 exemption amount. No gift tax. No tax to you, no tax to your friend. Now, the only however or in addition I have for you, Jim, is that you can give your friend an additional gift. And that additional gift is to calculate and document your basis in this property. We're talking about gift taxes and estate taxes, the transfer taxes that we have here in the United States. You also have income taxes, of course. So if your friend were to sell the home down the road, his basis or her basis would be your basis. In other words, when you give somebody, this is an important consideration when making gifts of assets other than cash, that your basis becomes their basis. It's a carryover basis. And what I mean by that, for a home, for example, you originally paid for it, plus any improvements you made. So let's just say that you've got 100 in it and you give it to your friend and it's worth 250 at the time. Their basis is going to be the 100,000 that you've got in it. So then let's say they then down the road, they hold that property for quite a while, and then down the road they sell it. And let's just say, again, I'm going to use an extreme example. Let's say if instead of it being worth 250, let's say we have another, they hold it for a long time and there's a big housing growth of real estate. And let's just say it's worth $1 million. When you gave it to them, it was worth $250,000. You paid $100,000 for it. It's worth $1 million now. They sell it. There's a $900,000 gain. The gain is based on what you paid for it. The gift is to tell them this information when you give it to them, because it'll be a lot of homework for them later to go and find this information. It may be very difficult for them to get this information about your basis, but that is an important thing for them to be aware of when you give them this gift, which is very generous and very significant, that they understand that there's a carryover of basis of your basis, and to caution them. Now, current rules is there, of course, can be an exclusion of profit, depending on whether they're single or married, of $250,000 or $500,000 of the profit. But they got a basis of 100, and even if they're married, they get $500,000 exemption amount. Then you're looking at what you can shield 500 of the 900 gain. There's still $400,000 in taxable gains. So that could be very, very significant. Of course, my example is a bit exaggerated, but you get the point. There are tax considerations beyond the gift tax that you need to caution your friend about. And of course, I don't say this enough. I would certainly recommend that you speak to a knowledgeable tax preparer, and your friend should as well, to make sure that you do this properly. And if you need assistance with that 709 form, working with a CPA is a good thing to do. All right. Thank you for that question, Jim. We're going to take a short break. Come back. I have some other timely suggestions for you about some planning that needs to be done. Stay tuned.
Have you noticed most of the financial literature available is either so specific it doesn't apply, or too generic to answer even the most basic questions? This revelation inspired David Holland to write his first two books, Confessions of a Financial Planner, Secrets to a Secure Retirement, and How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Financial Scams. These how-to guides contain easily accessible information on a wide variety of topics concerning personal finances. An effortless weekend read. You'll find clarification on what a mutual fund is, how to choose the right financial professional, and much more. Call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN to request a free excerpt from David's first book, Secrets to a Secure Retirement. The number again is 888-747-7526. Or visit davidholland.com for more information on this innovative book series.
Welcome back. Hey, I was at the library the other day. I did a little talk. I was invited by the Port Orange Library not long ago to do a little talk at the library. That's very nice of them. The Friends of the Library arranged that, and I'm flattered. Thank you very much. And by the way, my books are in the public library system. If you don't want to get one directly from me, let me digress. We always talk about my books there. I have a little spot there. You hear about my books. You can get my books on Amazon.com. They are $20 and $10 respectively. If you come in and visit with me, you'll get a free copy of How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Scams. And then if we are going to meet again, looks like maybe I can help you. I'll send you home with some homework, which is to read Secrets to a Secure Retirement, which is the second book. But if you're out at the library, you want to pick up a copy. Both books are at the public library. I donated 10 copies of both books to the library. So I'm a fan of the library, and I was at the library the other day. And I was asked questions by the audience. Typically, when I do a talk, I say, what questions do you have? I bring a whiteboard, and I write your questions on my board, and then I answer them. So here are some questions. These are real questions from real people, just like you listening to the program. First question is, and this is a very important question, and if you've listened to my program, you know that I have a special interest or concern for widows and for women to make sure that they are able to, you know, take care of things with their finances if their spouse dies. So the question I got from one of the persons attending the talk I did was, what should a widow do about her finances? And I'm going to answer that with a couple of things. First of all, and I'm not trying to be cute because this is serious, but the best time to get financially prepared for being a widow is before you are one. There are reasons why the experts out there say, wait 6 months to a year before making any big financial moves after the death of your spouse, because what they're trying to caution you about is not to make an emotional decision after the death of the spouse to jump into something that maybe you don't know enough about or you're not thinking clearly. So you have time to work through those emotions and then be able to be clear-headed. Now, I'm going to agree but then disagree with those experts, whoever they may be and whoever they may say they are. I'm going to say it's actually much better to do the planning and to think about your financial future as a woman. All of this applies for men as well, but for women, I'm going to speak to you directly. The best thing you can do is to prepare for the loss of one of the spouses while both of you are alive. And here's what you do. You ask a financial planner you trust to give you some what-if scenarios. And then once you go through those what-if scenarios, you'll identify if there's any problems if something happens to one of you. I'm looking at the financial aspect. And then they can help you address and put together some recommendations for you to address any shortfalls that may be in place or be prepared. Now, if you're already a widow, the most important thing to do is to make sure that you've got a guide to help you through these important decisions. And it's not uncommon for widows, 60 to 70% of widows change advisors after the death of their husband. Now, I'm going to give you another big word of caution. Be very careful about accepting financial advice from friends and family. A lot of times when there is a widow, you know, the friends want to help, but they mean well. But I've seen family members and friends too swoop in and try to help a widow and make a real mess. You know, instead of asking them for advice, which some of them may be uncomfortable, or maybe they don't want to give you bad advice, or even if they offer advice, here's a better idea. Ask your friend to join you or your family, join you when you go to interview advisors. Use that part of your relationship with them. Use them for emotional support. Use them to help you judge. I've had people come in, bring a friend and or bring a family member, maybe when they have been widowed or they are looking for an advisor and they just aren't comfortable doing it. I think that's a wonderful idea. I welcome that, please. No problem. So take that advice, and I think you'll be in a better position. Another question from my audience at the library the other day. Gentleman said, I had a bad experience with a stockbroker. I didn't like paying commissions. Is there another way to work with a financial advisor? That's a real question, and I'm happy to answer it for you. The most important part, I'm going to twist it a little bit, though. It's not going to be quite what you expect. The most important part of paying an advisor is to know what it is up front. There are different ways for advisors to be compensated. And people have preferences. Advisors have preferences on how they want to be compensated. And also where they work, if they're employed by a firm or if they have their own firm, all of those things will affect how the advisor is compensated. There's more than one way to work with an advisor. You can pay a commission for each transaction or trade. That's the traditional brokerage relationship. You could pay an hourly fee for planning and advice. You could pay a flat financial planning fee and manage the money yourself. You could pay a percentage for somebody to manage the money. So you can shop around, and more and more advisors, we're seeing this movement in the industry where a lot of advisors are moving from the brokerage arena and moving over to be an independent investment advisor firms where they charge a percentage for managing your account. Another question, I read about scams almost every day. What can I do to safeguard my investments? Well, there's a lot you can do. To protect your investments, you need to be prepared for an attack on what I would call two fronts. First, you have the risk of loss of your investment's value. Okay, that can be caused by declining the overall market, or stock or bond, or the individual investments themselves. And then you've also got the risk of loss of your investment value or the investments to a scam artist or somebody that steals your identity. Because you want to protect what you've accumulated, you know, you can look for lower risk options. And I talk about that on the show because a lot of times people say, look, I'm getting ready to retire or I'm already retired. I don't want to keep all my money in the market. So what else can I do? And we've talked about this. So I'll just hit it again. Money market, CDs, fixed annuities, cash, checking. Those are your safe choices where you're not going to be putting your money at risk. We've talked about some of the other options being, but they do have some risk. Now, let me share something else about from protecting your money from the scammers or con artists. You keep control over your money. You keep it safe. Here's the thing. Don't go looking for the exotic get-rich-quick schemes or opportunities. They usually end up with somebody else getting control over your money and walking off with it. So, you know, the beaten path is beaten for a reason. Stay on the beaten path. When you get out in the woods, that's where the bad guys are. That's where the lions, tigers, and bears are hiding. So just keep on that straight path. Don't ever write a check to the advisor or to their firm. Don't do personal loans. Don't invest in a small private business. You know, the investing in the car wash and the startup restaurant, all these things have substantial risk. You may never see your money again. And if you're having trouble getting records from an investment like that, please don't put good money after bad. Safer places for your money, where the scammers, it's hard for them to get at it. Banks and credit unions, they've got good security procedures in place. Brokerage firms, my client money is held at Fidelity that I manage the investments. Fidelity holds that money. So they have substantial procedures in place to protect the security of that money and to keep somebody from getting it. And then insurance companies. We work with insurance companies to hold money. And they have also robust systems in place. Those are all safer places where the account is in your name, it's under your control. And that is how you protect your money. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars goes into these companies and they have procedures. So, you know, keep your money somewhere like that and you can keep yourself from being a victim. And it happens. And it happens. You know, somebody the other day asked me, you know, I feel vulnerable. I don't have a lot of money. I feel vulnerable. I don't know. How do wealthy people protect their money? And you know what the truth is? If you add a zero or two to what you've got, it's really the same thing. Wealthier people, people that we would call well-to-do, they have some of the same challenges with people trying to get their money, and they sometimes fall prey. They know the guy at the country club. They think he's an okay guy. He's a friend of theirs. And then you find out later after they've invested with him because they think they know him, they find out later they scammed him out of their money. So it's not scamming and deceit doesn't necessarily follow sophistication or how much money you got in your account or your investment account. All right. That's all the time we have for today. Please be sure to join us again. Thank you.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.